Hi, everybody. Welcome. This is Beyond Awakening, the future of spiritual practice. I'm Terry Patton, the creator and host of this series. For those of you who don't already know me, I'm also the founder and teacher of Integral Spiritual Practice and the author of Integral Life Practice with Ken Wilber. Today, we'll be continuing our exploration of how higher consciousness can make good on its promise to be the resource that can enable human beings to uplift and change our world. I convened this series to serve the evolution of consciousness and culture by creating a rich and wide-ranging public dialogue about how spirituality can play a key role in helping us find the inner resources that can enable human beings to rise to the challenges of our world's current crises so that we can make a transition to a sustainable human presence on this planet. I've held a series of profound and enlivening conversations on this topic with many of today's leading spiritual teachers and thought leaders. Once you've registered at beyondawakeningseries.com, they're all available for free to download at beyondawakeningseries.com/blog. This morning, I'm happy to be joined by John Stewart and Lawrence Wallersheim to continue that discussion in a conversation entitled The Evolutionary Manifesto. The way this will work is that I'll introduce John and Lawrence and we'll dialogue for about an hour. And then I'll make some announcements and we'll spend about a half an hour taking your questions. And we'll finish up in about 90 minutes. John Stewart is an Australian-born evolutionary theorist and activist whose main focus has been the trajectory of evolution. His work focuses on the development of a rational, tightly reasoned worldview that reveals to us who we are and what we should be doing with our lives. His work on the directionality of evolution and its implications for humanity has been published in a number of key papers in international science journals. These include papers on the potential for human beings to enhance their psychological capacities through the future evolution of consciousness. He's the author of the internationally acclaimed book, Evolution's Arrow, The Direction of Evolution and the Future of Humanity. More recently, he's finalized The Evolutionary Manifesto, which outlines an evolutionary worldview and explores its relevance to humanity. The manifesto presents the rationale of the worldview and uses it to identify the actions that we need to take if humanity is to fulfill its potential and contribute positively to the future evolution of life in the universe. His website is evolutionarymanifesto.com. Lawrence Wallersheim is the executive director of Integrative Spirituality, an integral evolutionary organization in the San Francisco Bay Area that has also birthed the Universe Spirituality Movement. He's currently writing a book on evolutionary ethics, and Lawrence has also helped to found the Universe College and the Universe Academy for Evolutionaries, as well as the Universe Institute. He's a passionate advocate for the new universe worldview based upon progressive evolution. And he has several websites. Probably the best place to start to connect to all his websites is universespirit.org. Well, thank you both for being my guests today, John and Lawrence. I'm really happy to welcome you.
It's great to be here, Terry.
Wonderful. Well, maybe the best way for us to begin, John, if you could offer us a short summary statement. I mean, you have a lot to say on the subject, but just to introduce people to what is the essential message of the Evolutionary Manifesto?
Basically, that we're in a larger process, a larger evolutionary process that is directional. And the importance of direction in evolution is that if there's a direction in evolution, it means that evolution is favouring certain characteristics. So we can see from the direction of evolution what it is that humanity must do and life on this planet must do if it is to continue to be favoured by evolution. That is, if we're to thrive and survive into the future. So we can read off the direction of of evolution, what we need to do for the future and how we need to do it. And that's highly significant, probably the most extraordinary thing that comes out of an understanding of the bigger picture in which we're embedded, is that there's a role for us in evolution. That is, it's not just a process that acts on us passively and that will take us in its direction. Instead, the extraordinary thing about evolution and an understanding of this bigger picture is that it looks like we're in the midst of a developmental process. And it's a developmental process similar to the way in which a chicken embryo develops within an egg. That is, there's a larger process unfolding. But for the success of that process, the extraordinary thing is that we have to wake up to what that process is. For the success of the process, we have to understand what our role is, and we have to intentionally fulfill that role and intentionally advance the evolutionary process. So that's a very abstract description of it, but basically what the manifesto does is it outlines the evolutionary worldview, it outlines this big picture, it identifies the direction of evolution, and it then identifies what humanity must do to advance that process on this planet. And that has consequences for our political structures, our social structures, the way we organise ourselves, and also importantly, it has consequences for what we do in our day-to-day lives. It identifies how we can live a life here and now, moment to moment, in the evolutionary big picture.
And what are those implications for me right now, or for those of us who are listening on the line right now? How does one bring that alive in our own lives?
Well, the direction of evolution basically on this planet has been towards larger and larger scale cooperation. So life began on this planet as infinitesimal cooperative entities about a millionth of a metre across. And then since then there's been progressive integration of living processes into larger and larger wholes. We're now on the verge of an integrated living process on the scale of the planet. So it's easy to extrapolate that process into the future, and that tells us basically where we've got to go. And where we've got to go is towards a unified and sustainable cooperative organisation of living processes on the scale of the planet. So that's broadly where it goes. We can read off from past evolution how you do that, how you do create these larger scale cooperative organisations. Evolution's been doing it for over 2 billion years on this planet. Evolution is the great organiser, it's the great cooperative organiser. So it tells us what we have to do, how we have to organise that planetary society. So the question, your specific question is, what does that mean for you and me here and now? It's a question, and the answer to that question is it's what we can do here and now that moves the planet in that direction. So there's broadly social, political things you can do, the evolutionary worldview, motivating other people to join together and create a movement of sufficient scale and power to have an influence on political and social events. Importantly also, it's important for individuals to build capacity. So your effectiveness as an activist, as an evolutionary activist, depends upon your cognitive capacities and your ability to align your motivations and passions behind what you need to do in order to contribute to an evolutionary movement and to evolutionary activism. So that capacity building brings us to very specific things we do in our ordinary life, and in particular, the foundation of capacity building is to use the practices adapted from the spiritual and contemplative traditions as a tool, as a very significant tool for developing higher cognition, which gives you the capacity to strategize in global terms, and also to align your emotions and motivations and so on behind those evolutionary strategies.
So that's really helpful and clear. It was a wonderful introduction. Thanks so much, John. I really appreciate that as a foundation for a conversation. And then I want to invite you in, Lawrence. Maybe the next question that arises for me, maybe one that is kind of well suited for you to address. So with that as the context for this discussion, what does spirituality have to do with it?
Well, there's the positive side, which is many of our spiritual disciplines have helped us to focus attention and be aware of our thoughts and treat our thoughts as objects. And this integrates this consciousness, this aware consciousness, is the critical doorway that integrates with a great new evolutionary development in thinking. This, for lack of a better term, I'm going to call it integral dialectical thinking for complex systems. And it's way beyond the thinking of the first enlightenment of rational, analytical, linear, scientific methodology. While it includes it and sits on top of it, it far transcends it, and it's a natural evolutionary development. And this new thinking, this integral dialectical thinking for complex systems, requires the ability to focus attention and treat thought as an object, to put it out in front of you almost as a four-dimensional object that you can spin around when some basic thought or proposition. And the reason that's so important is the consciousness opens a door, but we can't solve the problems, the challenges of today with two-dimensional scientific methodology alone. We need this next upstep in thinking. And amazingly, it's been those spiritual disciplines that have trained attention focusing and treating thought as object that are going to be a great surge forward in moving this evolutionary development of this new second enlightenment integral dialectic thinking forward. Because when we have this thinking, we can analyze these complex interacting systems, come up with the right plan, not a rational, analytical, first enlightenment plan that was linear and doesn't really understand complex systems. If we can come up with a plan appropriate to the problems of today, then we can act upon it. So the spiritual consciousness, this attention focusing and treating thought and emotions as an object outside oneself and not oneself, are the essential basis, the essential developmental foundation to stepping into the thinking, the cognitive abilities that will take on the challenges of the future and solve them in an effective way, not in a way that was appropriate to the 1600s in a tiny world. Now we're in a gigantic global society, and we need this new method to move forward.
That's very interesting. I can see that this conversation is heading toward something that I'm very interested to get into, having to do with developing much richer, more adequate and complex cognitive capacities. Both of you have brought that up. But before we go there, we've been having a really rich series of dialogues here on this program in which several people have kind of talked about spirituality in a totally different way as a source of utter freedom in the heart, and a source of love, and a source of a deep and rich love relationship to existence itself, perhaps understood as the goddess, as Andrew Harvey puts it, and a way of relating to the destruction of the larger ecosystems of the world, such that there's a profound sympathetic identification and the kind of sense almost of a crucifixion as these ruptures in the fabric of our life support systems are here to be witnessed, and the, you know, mass extinctions and climate change and all the rest, not to mention all the human war and famine and human suffering. You were talking about it in a somewhat cooler, more abstract kind of set of terms, like it's all about noticing thoughts as objects and so forth. What about those richer dimensions of people's spiritual experience? Do they have a role too?
John, do you want to start out?
I'd like to distinguish between two types of spiritual orientation and two types of uses of spiritual developmental tools. On the one hand, we can have communion-orientated spirituality, and on the other hand, we have agentic spirituality or agency-orientated spirituality. In the communion-orientated spirituality, or in spirituality towards that end of this continuum, and it clearly is a continuum, then the accent is on communion, fusing with the absolute, immersing oneself in feelings and so on. And so you can awaken in ordinary life and experience the world far more richly, far more vividly and so on. But basically it's an immersion, a communion with reality. Agency-orientated spirituality, on the other hand, is where awakening in the midst of ordinary life is a means to an end. It's the first step. So it's a similar sort of experience, awakening in the midst of ordinary life. However, that attainment is used to develop greater effectiveness in the world, agency in the world, a greater capacity to serve the needs of evolution. And broadly, there's two ways of doing that. As Lawrence has mentioned, from that perspective, the key efficacy of spiritual development is to be able to treat thought as object and to free attention from embeddedness in thinking, to disembed from thought. So at this time in the development and evolution of humanity, it's to disembed from analytical rational thinking, the thinking of the first enlightenment, to stand outside that, see its limitations, free attention so that attention can be moved around to look at those things that are left out by analytical cognition, and therefore to develop better maps of the world. And those better maps can inform better strategies and can inform a better understanding of what humanity has to do to proceed successfully into the future. The second thing that awakening in the midst of ordinary life can achieve is not just the standing outside thought, but also standing outside emotion and feeling, and being able to see emotion and feeling and motivation as object, and therefore to gain freedom from that. And therefore, once you gain freedom from those desires and motivations in us that have been shaped by previous evolution, then you can move at right angles to them where necessary and be effective in future evolution. So that's how I'd answer your question. I distinguish between the agency-orientated stuff, the communion-orientated stuff. The communion-orientated stuff is still very important in terms of emotion and feeling and immersion in the world and motivation and so on. But the evolutionary worldview, I would argue, favours particularly the agency-orientated aspect of waking up and of spiritual development.
I'd add a little something to that, John. You know that I have a slightly different perspective with some of my spiritual background. And I would say that the role of spirituality for so many of the people in the population is that it expands their scale of empathy. Probably nothing expands the scale of empathy from one's group and one's nation to the world and to the universe as much as spirituality does, because spirituality forces in its in an invisible way, the individual to see the all. Whatever that definition of the all or the great mystery, the interconnectedness, the totality of things, which then opens up empathy. And when that empathy is opened up, whether it's opened up through spiritual development in one of the great traditions and the myths and metaphors and allegories and stories and experiences that one has, or whether it's opened up through an intense study of the new sciences, which is itself a mysticism at this point. It's developed so far, and I don't mean mysticism in the sense of the classic mysticism, but I mean in the sense of producing awe and wonder at the interconnectedness and the totality of everything and its beauty. So both of these paths, you know, the communion in the agency side, the increasing of empathy through spirituality, all of these are essential to where a person is in their personal evolution. Some personality types are going to just, you know, gravitate to a certain religious message, and that's going to be part of the total process of evolution, and evolution uses everything. So that's the beauty of this evolutionary process. Nothing goes wasted. And all of those individuals who are increasing their scale of empathy and developing connection, a sense of interconnectedness and empathy for the planet and for humanity as a totality and the importance of us being non-dualistic and seeing our unities, these are great moves forward. And it's not an either or. And now add in cognitive training, the new cognitive training to think with the second enlightenment thinking processes, and then add in an action plan behind it to harness the motivation and energy behind that empathy and really be able to come together as a unified community to actually deal with these challenges. And here again, I'm sorry, but I'm very excited about this. The universe and its evolutionary process has now given us a set of universal evolutionary ethics, which include and transcend the best of all of our previous moral and ethical systems, but it gives us a common ground, a common set of principles that every community of consciousness now can say, these are the minimums that we hold everyone accountable to. And when you have common agreement, you can have flow. And when you have flow, you can have power. And that's what we need to get to solving these problems. We need the new thinking, we need an action plan, and we need the agreement flow of power of all of these communities pulling the oars in the same direction. And handling
you mean these are communities of spiritual practice that are similar to those who might be on this call? You're probably not including the folks who were rallying with Rick Perry in a stadium recently, or who were the Christian fundamentalists behind the Tea Party or Glenn Beck's rallies, or those folks.
Unfortunately, I'm going to disappoint you there, Terry.
You do include them
because they're part of evolution. So
they're going to be pulling the oars along with us, even though we just about defaulted on our.
No, they're going to be motivating us to pull the oars farther, because they're the evolutionary tension and the retrograde trajectory, which creates the back pressure, which moves the motions of evolution. It moves it even farther, faster, with more dynamic tension and energy. The universe, the evolutionary progress uses extinctions, retrogrades, wrong experiments or tangents. It uses everything. All of these forces are moving us towards that globalized world that's in line with the progressive direction of evolution. There's no duality here. Evolution doesn't separate, it uses.
Well, if I might come in there.
Yeah, please.
I think that's right. That and it's clearly seen in biological evolution that biological evolution proceeds by the production of enormous variation, and then natural selection operates on that variation to perpetuate the most adapted and so on. So, yes, everything has a role to play in this evolution. If we look at it from the perspective of intentional evolution, that is of people across this planet who are beginning to wake up to the direction of evolution and use that direction of evolution to guide their own actions and activities, then intentional evolutionaries, they won't intentionally fulfill this enormous diversity of roles. Intentional evolutionaries won't be adopting roles that they can see from the direction of evolution are going to be extincted as the process unfolds. So from the point of view of intentional evolutions, from the point of view of intentional evolution, all roles, all potential actions are not equal. Some are more effective ways of advancing the process than others. And that's a very important point, I think, about the evolutionary worldview, that it does move beyond cultural relativism. The evolutionary worldview basically does identify intentional actions that will successfully advance the process and others that won't be so successful in doing it. And this also comes back to and resonates with what Lawrence is saying about an evolutionary ethics. The evolutionary worldview, the direction of evolution, the identification of those things that evolutionaries need to do to advance the process, then all of that helps us identify an evolutionary ethic, that is, ways of behaving in the world that are aligned with how the big picture is unfolding, that are aligned with this larger scheme of things and have a positive impact on that larger scheme of things. So the evolutionary worldview does have an up and a down. It does have a hierarchy of values and so on.
Well, this makes me interested. There are all kinds of side questions that are coming up to me, but I know that probably most of the folks on the line are curious just to see then how this pays off. So how would this cognitive complexity, can you give an example or can you sketch out less abstractly? I sense that the tension here, the place we might be challenged is that these sound like wonderful philosophical ideas that are very big picture, but they're kind of abstract. How does this actually show up? Do you have specific embodiments that you can envision, or can you describe some of the more complex dimensional kinds of problem solving that you see emerging? Can we get a feeling for how we can grow into being capable of that kind of participation ourselves personally, and how we could cooperate and express it together? And are there examples of policymakers or activists who are embodying this kind of complexity in a way that you could, point to and that we could learn from?
I can start with sort of a narrow, specific example to try and just give a feel for the difference that's made by dialectical systems cognition. It's a very common view that's expressed in the culture that corporations should be more ethical, that corporations should care for the environment, should be more environmentally responsible. And, a number of corporations are seen to respond to that positively, and they have their public relations people and so on, and their strategists get together and look at ways in which they can often cheaply look as if they're, being environmentally responsible. So to the analytical rational cognition of the First Enlightenment, when you try and understand that situation, it seems a reasonable call to exhort corporations to be more environmentally responsible, given the challenges that face us. Because in that analytical rational cognitive way of modelling the world, corporations are entities, they have choices, and I should behave in ways which don't lead to the destruction of the planet. Now, what systemic dialectical cognition does to that is that it gives attention to what that rational analytical model left out. And what the rational analytical model leaves out is that corporations in a competitive market are embedded in a much wider system, and that wider system renders certain activities impossible. It renders certain activities ineffective and precludes them from happening. And basically one of the things it precludes is businesses in a competitive market investing substantially in pro-environmental processes and requirements. Because if they invest in those and their competitors don't, they'll be disadvantaged competitively. That will have to be reflected in their prices. So businesses, corporations running power stations these days, they could invest a significant amount of money in reducing carbon dioxide emissions, but if they did so, the price of the power that they sell would have to go up. If their competitors didn't do it, they'd be outcompeted. So to sit back and exhort corporations like that to be environmentally responsible when they're embedded in a larger dynamic that punishes them if they do it, is ineffective. So what the systemic dialectical cognition sees in that situation, first of all, it sees a larger context and larger processes unfolding that preclude certain strategies, and it helps identify effective strategies. And the effective strategy in that circumstance is not to go around berating corporations for being not environmentally conscious. The effective solution is to change the dynamic in which they're embedded, to change the system they're embedded so that it no longer penalises environmentally responsible behaviour, but instead rewards that behaviour. And things like carbon taxes putting a price on carbon, basically the end result of that is that it makes the production of carbon dioxide emissions more costly, less effective as a competitive and market strategy. So what the systemic cognition points to, broadly speaking, in that circumstance, is how you can align the interests of corporations with the wider interests of the planet by embedding them in a context that rewards the behaviour, supports the behaviour that benefits the planet, and punishes the behaviour that acts against the interests of the planet. And once you set up a system like that, then corporations will do the right thing because it's the effect, it's the thing that maximises their profits. So that's a broad example of systemic thinking and how it can illuminate parts of reality and help us to better understand parts of reality that analytical cognition won't effectively understand.
And there's much more to it than what John was saying as well. That excellent example is, kind of a simplification of just a few of the perspectives of the dialectical thinking toolbox. If the listener could imagine a three-dimensional square in front of them, and on the sides of those squares would be the four meta-dimensions of this new thinking, which is all the factors dealing with context. On the next side of the square, all the factors dealing with process. On the next side of the square, all the factors dealing with relationship. And on the last, the other side of the square, all the factors dealing with life being a constantly transforming living system, where everything is moving and changing. And then if they could imagine on each of those four sides, there's seven sub-perspectives that are not insignificant, that force you to look at, say your partner might be embezzling money from your company, and you don't know what to do. Well, if you use the old rational, linear, logical thinking, it would take you so far. But if you understood this new complex systems dialectical thinking, you'd be able to look at what he may be doing through these four major dimensions of process, context, relationship, and living systems, dynamic transformational systems. But you'd even be able to take each one of those down seven more layers of really rich perspective that would allow you to look at everything from your own biases to the biases of the culture to spontaneities and unpredictable situations and to nonlinear feedback loops and how interacting systems, multiple systems are affecting what's going on. And instead of a very limited option, rational, logical, this is what I do, your options of solving the problem of a potential problem partner embezzling from your company becomes much richer. And when you have more options, and they're richer options, the probability of getting a better solution is much higher. The funny thing about this new thinking is it's a natural evolutionary development in our finest leaders. Some of our leaders who, in this process of discovering it, had four or six of these 28 different perspectives of dialectical thinking. At some point, they started assembling all these into this whole picture of here's the whole process. Also, women in many ways can relate to that they see and hold so many opposites and so many perspectives on a situation. Sometimes women, more mature women, develop quite a few aspects of dialectical thinking, but they do it as a natural developmental process and very informally. Imagine if we could all have the benefits of this amazing, I mean, this is the thinking of the 21st century. This is the thinking of the Second Enlightenment. And if we all could have trained in these tools that sit up on top of rational analytical and allow us to do these complex interacting systems that we live in today and do them with much more effectiveness. That kind of trying to add a little bit more of the richness of this thinking to the very good example and focused example John just mentioned.
So, you know, that sounds good. I certainly think about those kinds of things when I think about activist issues. But when I think about all of this, when I engage it, I feel like the spirituality is the source of care, of passion, of a higher sense of well-being, of a kind of courage and a kind of commitment and clarity that have me identified with the whole force of evolution itself and committed to the well-being of not just even of the human beings that are alive today, but or the other creatures that are alive today or plants, but the, you know, not just even the current biosphere, but the whole trajectory of what it is that it is in the process of manifesting, which goes beyond our lives now. And my sense of connection to all of that is one of awe and wonder and gratitude and inspiration. And in that infilling of all of that spiritual uplift, I have extra powers of just like a young mother of a small woman, maybe a 110-pound woman, could lift a car up enough that her child could get out from under its wheels. You know, I have a different level of power in my clarity and in my commitment because I'm spiritually inspired. Does that have a place in your model of the spiritual dimension of this evolutionary worldview? How does that relate?
What you say definitely resonates with my understanding and my experience. So the spacious consciousness, being awake, being mindful, enables and facilitates the perception of these larger evolutionary processes, and in particular of humanity's role in it, and the realization that the things we do now matter in a larger scheme of things, and that there is a bigger picture that's emerging, that's making sense of human existence. So the development of consciousness that's produced by spiritual development definitely enables the perception of that larger picture, and that the perception of the larger picture with disembedded consciousness enables that larger picture to work on us very deeply and to evoke powerful emotions. And that in turn evokes very powerful motivations and so on. So that's definitely a very significant part of it. I suppose what I'm emphasizing here is that to take that experience and that power of the spiritual awakening to the next level, the better the understanding you have of the bigger picture of these larger scale processes and how they're unfolding, then the more that your motivation is evoked, the more that awe is evoked, and so on. So it's a question of using the spacious consciousness together with cognition to understand what's going on. That will align interests, align motivations, and so on, and then also inform the development of strategies for doing something positive about it and having a positive impact on the future.
Terry, also the spirituality that you talk about, you speak of interconnection, awe, and wonder. The original spirituality, many people would probably concede, is the physical universe, and it has been a continual source of spirituality for many different traditions. And what's happened today is the older experiences of spirituality, because of the massive breakthroughs in science with the Hubble and the supercomputers, seeing the whole universe in new ways, what's happening is that we're linking the old spirituality to the new spirituality. Carl Sagan said, you know, the universe is the new religion. And the universe scientists are just seeing this interconnection. They're seeing the awe and wonder at levels that humanity's never seen through the new instrumentation, you know, that shows the whole universe, all 13.7 billion years, all 200 billion light years across. And they're having the same experiences, but they're having them on a dialectical and a rational and a different experience than the traditional spirituality. So what I'm suggesting is we don't have an either or here. We have a linking of old spirituality to the new spirituality of the universe that's being brought forward by rational evolutionary science and hard facts that our scientists are discovering about the progressive nature of evolution. Does that help at all?
Yeah, it does. You know, and one of the things that what it brings forth is something that I very much appreciate about this dialogue and about the points of view that both of you are bringing to the larger, very rich discourse on these topics, which is a very tightly reasoned, very rational, and transrational spirituality does have its foundations in a fully rational and evidence-based and high quality critical thinking as its foundation. And I think that perhaps more than any other speakers I've had on this whole series of dialogues in this program, which are about 40 now, I think what I see, particularly I'm thinking of the Evolutionary Manifesto, just a very, very tightly reasoned, beautiful expression. And, for those of you who aren't already familiar with John's writings, the Evolutionary Manifesto and Evolution Zero are very much worth reading, because in a very detailed and rigorous way, he builds the logical links between all kinds of things that we see and that are consensual in the reality that everybody accepts, to a recognition of the larger responsibilities that we have in this time and the responsibility, therefore, to clarify our own consciousness in some of the ways that meditation allows, like the disembedding that he described, such that we can begin to find a sense of meaning and purpose and inspiration on behalf of this larger evolutionary process, and that there is a future to this evolution that only human beings can midwife into the next levels of its expression. I think that's well expressed in the written materials. And in this dialogue, I'm hoping we can kind of venture out onto the skinny branches even beyond that level of the discussion. And I hope that in this, you might have an opportunity to talk about, I think there's some critiques. Lawrence, you've certainly intimated that you see consciousness really as a doorway to resolving the world's challenges, but not the core of the solution. And I'm curious as to how, maybe that's a challenge to some of the discourse I've been having with other teachers here. Could you elaborate on that?
Well, John, I'd like to let you lead on that because you've expressed some great views, and then I'll just add anything, if that's okay with you, John.
Right, yeah, fine. I often express it by saying that, provocatively, that enlightenment is a means to an end. It's not an end in itself. And similarly, awakening is a means to an end, not an end in itself. And, the title of your series, Terry, is obviously highly relevant to that perspective. So it's a means to an end in the sense that, or a doorway in the sense that I mentioned earlier, and that is higher consciousness, disembedding, awakening, spacious awareness is a way of seeing our thoughts and feelings as objects and therefore being able to move at right angles to them. Seeing their limitations, seeing more effective ways of being, and more effective ways of operating in the world. So first enlightenment can be seen as the unity experience, absorption in the absolute, and so on. What I'm suggesting is that the actual capacities that you get from the states of consciousness that are often described in relation to enlightenment can actually be used to make us more effective in the world by enhancing our cognition, enhancing our emotional intelligence, enabling us to align our motivations and our desires and our passions with what we need to do in this world, here and now, in the material world, to advance the evolutionary process.
I would add I'm sorry, John, were you finished?
Yeah, no, I'm finished, thanks. Yeah.
I would
over
add
to you, Laura.
Classic, thank you. I would add the classic 10 bulls of Buddhism for those of you, those images, the 10 pictures, images of the development of Buddhism. The 10th image, I believe, is carrying water and chopping wood. The person who's enlightened, he's gone through the whole process and he's back to doing what he did in the first image, but he's doing it at a whole nother level. Consciousness is, I do believe it's the doorway. It's 10%. Spiritual consciousness and spiritual development is 10% of the process. It's the factual evolutionary change that opens you to, the sense of non-duality and interconnection with the universe. And what's really important is that driving empathy of the heart. But unless one can have a good plan for the challenges that humanity faces at this critical juncture, and that's the higher cognitive abilities of this new dialectical thinking, and then unless one is actively engaged in the service of those wiser plans, consciousness and spirituality can be, like Marx said, an opiate. You can feel so comfortable in your cocoon, whether it's Marin or whether it's your commune or whether it's your meditation room, and the world is burning outside of you. But because you're so connected and so in awe and so much in your daily meditation and you've got this inner peace, you forget that evolutionary tension and anxiety, it's the motivation and energy for us to grow and evolve, and that's so much a part of spiritual process. And the pain and suffering in the world has to be brought into our process, our spiritual process, and to ignite us to coming together, to come with the right plan, and then following up with service and action. Honestly, in our consciousness communities in Northern California, I may get some feedback from other leaders, but we're spending way too much time in thinking, not thinking, but in the consciousness side of it, and far too little time in planning using the new tools and getting out in the real world with real service to society on plans that will actually solve the challenges that we have. Our spirituality is consciousness instead of just beginning with consciousness. And that's about all I want to say on that,
well,
before I start getting...
I really resonate with what you just said, Lawrence, but I often find it difficult to embody my activist motivations in ways that feel fully adequate. Are you engaging in forms of activism that you feel are paying off, that in injunction you just so beautifully spoke?
Yes, I am, but only partially, because I realized that I couldn't become active until I had a good plan. And when I started to read some of John's work and other evolutionary work, I started to see that the universe has provided a plan for us in its deep directional patterns, its repeated patterns, which become a natural ethics. And then once I saw that natural ethics, I then saw that this new dialectic thinking is necessary to look at the complexity of our interacting systems, and then using what the universe has as a template, how do we look at the complexity of the problem, study them from these 28 dimensions, you know, of this new 28 perspectives, and come up with really good solutions aligned to the patterns of evolution. And then once you have the right plan with the right alignment, you can act. I've started some of that action, but not nearly what I and our organization should be doing. But I can tell you, our whole organization is shifting in this direction as we start to publish more and tidy up the last little bits, because unless you feel you have an effective course of action, why run out there and just do something that's a me too, that's already proven, that's not really getting much headway against the tremendous challenges we face? We need to have coordinated, well-planned, extremely well-planned action, because we're really facing a momentum, a challenge. Never in human history will so much structural and radical change have to take place in the next 30 years for our species and future generations to do well. And we better darn well have a good plan, a really good plan, and we better be well coordinated as our multitude of advocacy groups around the world on this plan, or I don't know how we're going to make a dent. So yes, I am doing more, but yes, I was stalled until I honestly, in my heart, saw the plan was right, and that we're now aligned with the universe, the deep patterns, and now we start doing it.
So that sounds, I mean, I resonate with everything you said, except I didn't hear what your plan is very clearly. And maybe that's, is there a simple expression?
I'm going to kick this back, John, back to John. John and I have talked about this many times. John, let him have it.
Thanks for that, Lawrence. That's we call that a hospital pass in terms of the football we play in Australia here. You asked Lawrence about, you know, what's the nature of his activism. The nature of my activism is laid out in detail in the Evolutionary Manifesto and in a companion document called Strategies for Advancing Evolution. So the manifesto basically outlines the evolutionary worldview, gives the rationale for activism, and then the companion document, Strategies for Advancing Evolution, sets out the beginning of a plan or strategies for growing a powerful and effective evolutionary movement. Broadly speaking, you know, it covers quite a number of issues, and it's too difficult to just summarise shortly. But broadly speaking, you know, you have to build a movement. You have to have strategies to building a movement, because basically the, you know, individuals aren't of sufficient scale to have the power and the impact in the world. So people need to bind together. You need to build a movement that isn't like the movements of old, that are hierarchical, top-down, basically brain-dead. You need to have a movement that more follows the principles of dynamic, creative, intelligent, evolutionary systems that use parallel processing, that are distributed, that use collective intelligence, and so on. And where the ideas and the strategies that come to the fore basically compete with other strategies and ideas, and those that are the most effective are the ones that come to the fore, not the ones that people in authority in the movement, for example, you know, decide are the most effective. So the strategies for advancing evolution covers how you build an intelligent, creative, non-authoritarian, non-top-down sort of a movement. And then it uses an understanding of evolution to identify the sorts of things we have to do to create a sustainable and cooperative global society. So a sustainable and cooperative global society, you know, rolls easily off the tongue, or at least it does to me after all these years. But it's easier said than done. I mean, how do you unify humanity? How do you create how do you embed them in a system that self-organises towards sustainability, as opposed to our current systems that self-organise towards environmental destruction? Basically, an understanding of evolution and how it's repeatedly built cooperative organisations throughout its history enables us to see how to practically and effectively build that global society, and not depend upon, you know, us all becoming saints and all humans deciding that they're going to cooperate. So that's the Strategies for Advancing Evolution document. It's a first attempt. It's my attempt. It's not the result of a distributed parallel processing sort of process. It's the first attempt. And clearly, you know, as a movement develops, strategies will become more sophisticated and true to the evolutionary worldview that spawned it. Those strategies will evolve and be enhanced and so on. But let the work begin, and the sooner it begins and is effective, the better.
Well, that's great to hear. I mean, I'm you know, makes me more intrigued. I haven't read that document, and I will. I'll make a point of doing so. But I'm just looking at the clock. I wanted to leap in with a question. I guess I'll save it for after our break, John. After our break, I know a lot of the folks who are listening have questions too. Let you know, if you've called in by telephone, if you press *2 on your key set, that'll raise your hand. And so I invite you to do that anytime now, and we'll call on a few of you with your questions. If you're listening by computer, if you just type in a question in the Instant Teleseminar window, we'll take some of those as well. And while you're doing that, let me offer a couple of important announcements. First of all, I want to make sure that you know how to find out more about John Stewart's work. You can go to evolutionarymanifesto.com, and there you'll be able to find out more about John. You'll be able to read the entire Evolutionary Manifesto online, or you can download it on a PDF. And as I've said, it's a very tightly reasoned, clear, grounded analysis that begins with, I think, clear, non-controversial, rational, objective assessment of our current evolutionary situation. And from that, it infers the advancing evolutionary worldview and the moral call to a awakening. Now, there you'll also be able to find strategies for advancing evolution. And not only that, but his book, Evolution's Arrow, which I recommend you're getting a copy of, but you can get the text online. He will also be visiting the United States this September, giving talks to a number of groups in the San Francisco Bay Area, including to Bay Area Integral, which an organization that I founded and that has been a past sponsor of Beyond Awakening. And that talk will be on Thursday, the 15th of September. So please mark your calendars and let anybody else in this area know who you think might be interested. You can find out more information at bayareaintegral.com. And as details are available on other talks that John may be giving in the Bay Area, they'll be linked to on his website, evolutionarymanifesto.com. Also, while he's in the Bay Area, he is interested in meeting people who have experience in training systemic dialectical cognition. And if you have that kind of a background, he'd love to connect with you. You can contact him through his website. You can find out more about Lawrence Wallersheim's work on three very rich interconnected websites, universespirit.org, universecollege.org, and universeinstitute.org. If that's too much to remember, just stick with universespirit.org, and that contains very rich resources on integrative spirituality, universe spirituality, and this higher cognitive complexity, some of the specific writings that relate to this, including an appreciation of a pivotal paper by Otto Lasky and others can be found there. I also want to tell you about my online course, Integral Spiritual Practice. I am really just so happy about what has emerged from the process of creating this online course. As many of you know, I've been researching an integral approach to spirituality and spiritual practice for almost 40 years. I've been teaching it for the last approaching 8 years now. And what's obvious to me is how essential a rich and authentic daily practice is to real transformation or even full human happiness, and how hard it is for people to find their way into a truly transformative practice in today's world. It seems like you either have to choose between joining a cult on one hand or on the other hanging out in a relatively profane, mentalized popular culture where a truly powerful, sacred experience just doesn't get traction and really break you through to another level of awareness and living at another level of commitment and clarity. So I feel like it's a huge thing to have been able to develop an online course that reliably takes any sincere person who's willing to take up a daily practice in just 8 sessions to a whole new phase of life and consciousness. It's an eminently doable step-by-step process that takes you essentially from being a seeker to being a real practitioner in a way that is truly uncommon, being grounded in the most radical and embodied wisdom of the world's most highly awakened spiritual realizations, but also informed by the rational clarities of modern science and the latest neuroscience, for example, but even the understandings of postmodern philosophy and psychology. But the other thing that's important is it's not a hyper-masculine path of seeking. It's really that rarest of paths, a deeply heart-centered, self-compassionate, and humane path that still generates the heat, the yogic fire that's necessary for real transformation. And it's all in a high-efficiency, simple, doable form that's flexible and not too time-consuming. So what it is a dispensed learning course with audio, video, written materials, and you know, there's even music. You can download the course materials and proceed at your own pace, but in doing so, you'll be joining a community of active practitioners whose lives are genuinely changing, and there's an opportunity to get guidance from me, too, as you engage. So to find out more about that, please go to your web browser and type in the URL, theispcommunity.com, T-H-E-I-S-P. ISP stands for Integral Spiritual Practice, T-H-E-I-S-P, community.com. And then please stay on the line. At the end of the call, I'll tell you a little more about what's going to be coming up with our upcoming guests. In 2 weeks, I'll be interviewing Arjuna Arda for a dialogue entitled Cancel Your Subscription to Enlightenment. On September 18th, Hamid Ali, also known as A.H. Almas, the founder of the Diamond School, will be joining me. And there's more. And at the end, we'll also open up the line so we can hear each other's voices as we say goodbye. Okay, on to questions. Remember, press star 2 or type it in your telephone keypad. All right. We've got a couple of hands up, and we've got some questions. Well, here's a challenger. Monica from Stockbridge has a couple of challenges. First, she says, are we adding levels of complexity beyond what's really needed? When we open to higher levels of consciousness, we're directed to make decisions that benefit the whole. Isn't that what we're talking about? Why do we need to make these concepts more complicated? And she goes on to say, it doesn't have to be forced. When we develop spiritually, inspiration guides us as to the personal steps that we need to take in our own lives. These solutions are expressed as a result of responding to the pull of purpose. Do most people, upon growing in consciousness, actually sit in a corner of bliss, or do they break through barriers that lead them to implement and tap into the call that's been placed on their lives? I certainly believe it's the latter. Would you care to comment on that?
I think Ken Wilber and Alan Kuhn, developed their lattice structure, which described and summarised the development of consciousness. And they basically, I think, indicated that quite correctly that you can have higher states of consciousness at any sort of level of development. So it's possible to have higher states of consciousness at a very low level of cognitive development. A rather provocative way of saying that and encapsulating that is to say that if you're an idiot and you reach enlightenment, which is quite possible, then you'll be an enlightened idiot. You won't get with enlightenment higher cognitive capacity, which would then enable you to understand complex phenomena, manage complex phenomena, plot a course through a complex and difficult world, a course that involved understanding how that world will unfold into the future. Being in the present, being mindful, is very effective for responding immediately to things that arise in the world, but it doesn't bring with it necessarily the higher cognitive capacity that you need to see how what the next steps in evolution are on this planet, and how we're going to achieve those next steps, the complex strategies needed to move to a world that's organised in such a way that the interests of all on the planet are aligned with the interests of the planet as a whole, and therefore we don't destroy the planet as is happening at pace today. So whatever level of cognitive development and social emotional development a person is at, there is no question on an evidence-based view in my mind that waking up will maximise your capabilities at that level. But in itself, it won't transport you to higher levels of development. And therefore won't necessarily give you all the tools you need to serve the requirements of future evolution.
I would add just two things to that that were hard for me in my personal spiritual development to embrace. And one is, in evolution, probably the most agreed upon simple piece of progressive directionality that's that just embrace completely is the universe is becoming more complex. And if the universe is becoming more complex, we have to become better at managing complexity, because that is the direction of the universe we have to align with. And the second thing that was hard for me to digest in my original spiritual practice is that a lot of the new wisdom, the new knowledge and new facts is counterintuitive. That's coming out of our scientific discoveries. We can't know these things through our intuition or our feelings or our gut. It's literally it's opposite of what we would come to through intuition. So just relying on one part of our brain, our right brain, when we've been given a full brain that is left and right, I had to just kind of say, well, I need to integrate and balance both sides of it and carry that forward. So having to say to myself that, you know, intuition is not going to carry it, just my heart feelings aren't going to carry it. I have to be a fully integrated being that integrates complexity, cognitive thinking, the highest levels of cognitive thinking, along with my heart, along with my intuition, and balance integrate the two so that I can deal with the real patterns of evolution, which are increasing complexity. And whether I don't like complexity or not, I've got to deal with it. And the only way spiritually I could integrate all of it besides that position was realizing that internally as a being I could maintain the simplicity of what I was, but the everything surrounding me was becoming more complex. I hope that helps.
Thanks, Lawrence. I'd like to take a live caller. This one, you're in the 508 area code, listed as, this may not be you, but listed as Brian Bailey in Upton, Massachusetts. You're live on the line. Please introduce yourself and let us know your question.
Hi. My name is Benjamin, actually. Brian is my father. And I first wanted to really deeply express my gratitude for the work that all three of you have done. Because it seems to be about the balance and the integration of the individual and the collective. How do we balance our internal ecosystems while also dealing with all of the turmoil that we see outside? And I really liked the distinction that all potential actions are not equal, because when we intentionally evolve, we'll realize that we won't be occupying roles that are becoming obsolete. So for me, and I think that a lot of people on this call have a similar question, is when considering what that means, there seems to be so many issues and relationships to take into account. All of the different levels and stages of development that people around us in our personal lives are at, that other people in society are doing, pulling together and synthesizing all of the different initiatives that NGOs who may or may not be integrally informed but are kind of moving in the right direction are at. So it seems to become very complex and sophisticated decision-making analysis and synthesis that has to go on at the same time and kind of continue to evolve. And I think that one of the most important things that I see is when we talk about the grassroots movement and kind of engaging people to move forward and allow this culture to emerge through us, the question is how do we engage in that? How do we become more involved?
Thank you, Benjamin. John?
Yes, I mean, Benjamin seems to be saying that the complexity, the political complexity, the social complexity, the organisational complexity is overwhelming. Where do you start? How do you deal with it? You have the motivation, you have the desire, you feel the call, you know, to serve future evolution, the future success of life on this planet, but what do you do about it in the face of all that complexity? And I suppose that's basically what Lawrence and I have been trying to address here today, and that is that, firstly, spacious consciousness, or the development of consciousness is needed if one's to be able to cognise and hold in one's head models and understandings of those complex phenomena, and hence the notion that the development of consciousness is critical. But then that spaciousness needs to be taken advantage of, that spaciousness needs to be filled. And so that's where the development of cognitive capacities beyond the analytical rational are necessary and are enabled by that spacious consciousness. Analytical cognition, the cognition that first became widespread in the Enlightenment and has basically given us the world that we have today, good and bad. Analytical cognition divides things up into bits and looks at how they interact and follows through their interactions in its attempts to understand the world and to develop strategies and so on. And that's the cognition that's completely smashed and overwhelmed by complexity. Because if you have all these complex phenomena and you try and break them down into objects that interact and try and predict the consequences of all those interactions, then your analytical cognition will be completely overwhelmed. There'll be circular causation. You won't be able to follow things through. There'll be things coming out of left field and everything else. So all that speaks to the absolute need for a high level of cognition that can deal with that complexity. And that's what we're sort of talking about today.
In I know this provokes a question in my mind. Having studied some of these systems of identifying more and more complex thinking, many of them posit that we can grow without any defined limit in the richness and complexity of our cognitive structures, which would imply that even if we achieve much more complex models for reality that are less inadequate to deal with the complexity we're confronting, we're still probably dealing with something that isn't as complex as reality itself, that our thoughts will never fully match the complexity of our world, and therefore there'll always be a bit of a mismatch. And so we can be less inadequate, but never fully adequate. And therefore, our strategies probably won't be 100% effective in all respects, even though they may be as sophisticated as we're capable of at this stage in our own development. How do you account for that?
Well,
less inadequacy is what I aspire to. Basically, there are things about the world that are fundamentally unpredictable, and that we and artificial intelligence and collective intelligence might never be able to get a complete handle on. And there are ways of dealing with that. There are ways of dealing with uncertainty and unpredictability and so on, and there are smarter ways of dealing with that than other ways of dealing with it. But clearly the goal or the path to go down is to maximise our capacity to understand increasing areas of reality and to model them and to use those models to plot courses of action and so on. And I'd probably emphasise here it's that in many respects it's collective intelligence that will, you know, it's not just single brains trying to cognise all this and work it all out. It's collective intelligence, including increasingly integration with artificial intelligence. And artificial intelligence will be part of that collective. It won't be operating on its own like a brain in a vat, either. So all that will assist in cognising and understanding the world, seeing how to navigate it, and so on.
I would only add one thing.
Go ahead, Lawrence.
The new dialectical thinking is very humble. As you first introduced the question with how can you take it all in with the dialectical thinking, the new dialectical thinking says you can't even take in the single moment, the single snapshot of reality that's passing in front of you in a single base concept, let alone all of reality. So there's a tremendous humility in this thinking, and it provokes further humility.
Beautiful. Well, I resonate with that. Well, thanks so much, Benjamin. Your question provoked something really rich. We have another question from someone who has a Petaluma, California phone number, and the caller ID identifies as Joseph Stevenson. Welcome. You're on the air.
Oh, hello.
Please introduce yourself and let us know your question.
Well, my name is what it looks like on the ID, Joseph Stevenson or Joe. I guess it's kind of a comment question, but in the process of understanding where we are and what's going on around us. Can you hear me?
Yep. Yes, we hear you fine.
Okay. I'll switch from speakerphone to regular line. Having gone through my own spiritual journeys and practices and having been kind of a product of the 60s in this country of activism in a lot of different levels, one thing that seems to come clear to me over time is that if the focus is more from spirituality or our own thought process, even though it may extend to concern for what's happening in the rest of other parts of the world, the level at which most people are having to live their lives is so far removed from the expanded conceptual framework that we may be approaching things from, that their lives are largely guided by pretty much fundamental material survival. And if we're to look at some way in which all of those people are participants in a collective consciousness that can lead us to solutions to all of where we are now or to participate in our own evolution, don't we have to begin to think from a different place other than from the evolution of the individual? And that means to me maybe that finding ways to at least address the fundamentals of basic human survival almost as a foundation for anything else happening, so that all the other cells are actually participating in this process of figuring out what the broader solutions are to issues that can't even enter into the mind of a starving person in Somalia, for instance. So I guess I'm not pointing to anything specific about what I think
the question
should or shouldn't be doing. Just
when I think about issues like that, I think about the cooperative organizations that evolution has produced in the past and how it's done it, and how it's done it without all the cells in a cooperative organization developing higher capacities. So if we take our bodies, for example, if we take ourselves and look inside ourselves, each of us is a galaxy of 3 trillion or more cells, and none of those cells, know about us. They don't know that they're part of a whole. They don't have, therefore, can't have any care or concern for the whole. Yet, extraordinarily, those individual cells, the 3 trillion of them, when they go about their daily or the moment-to-moment business of being cells and doing what cells do, they produce this extraordinary coordinated galaxy that speaks to other galaxies of cells, that walks and talks and that thinks and is intelligent and so on. So evolution points to how you can organise a coordinated cooperative that self-organises in the interests of the whole, in the interests of that cooperative, in the interests of the whole organism. Past evolution shows us how to organise that out of self-interested components that don't have to be aware of and cognise the whole. So that's good news in the sense that what it points to is it's possible to organise a cooperative and sustainable global society, even though only a small proportion of humans might be aware of the whole, aware of how the whole needs to be organised, aware of strategies to get in there and so on. So, yes, while we've talked a lot this morning about the need for higher consciousness and how that can in turn lead to higher cognition and understanding of complex phenomena, the solutions to the immediate problems that face the world and taking the next great step in human evolution don't depend on all of humanity waking up, fortunately. Don't depend on all of us becoming saints, and any more than it depends on all of us developing systemic dialectical cognition.
I would add to that that every heart that feels the love of spirituality feels empathy, tremendous empathy for those individuals on the planet who are just barely trying to survive. And relating to love, there's a prime theological concept that's often forgot, that justice is always prior to love. If you want justice, you want love to work, you have to have justice functioning. And in evolution, the progressive direction of evolution are these new universal evolutionary ethics. And if we were able to teach those to the people in power and they really got these and understood them and started integrating them into our economic and political systems, we would have the justice at the highest levels that could rapidly realign our behaviors in alignment with the universe, which would then care for every member of the human community because we all are interconnected.
Okay. I mean, am I still able to speak or not?
Yes, we hear you.
Oh, okay. Yeah, So I'm just in my understanding of what each of you has indicated, that you think that it is possible that somehow collectively that certain numbers of us who may be more conscious can arrive at ways of bringing new systems into, or at least new approaches into the whole that will affect a different outcome than what we currently are living in. Is that?
Yes, that's right.
Yes, absolutely.
And you don't think it's necessary that those other cells be, as one example, participants in arriving at what would work?
No, they'll be participants in the larger system. And the larger system, because the larger system wants to be as creative and intelligent as it possibly can, to progress evolution further beyond the larger system and to continue the trajectory of evolution, the larger system will embrace everybody. It will maximise their potential. You don't maximise the creativity of the system by leaving some out. The scarcest resource in the larger system will be individuals and their creativity and so on. So they will be looked after. It'll be a developmental society. The fundamental ethos of a global society will be to develop all to their maximum potential.
Well, I hope you're right.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Joseph. We've gone a little over time, so I think we need to begin to wrap up. I know we could keep going with this kind of rich conversation all day, and I hope that you will continue to tune in to John's good work and Lawrence's. Thank you, everybody. Before I tell you what's coming up next week, I want to remind you, if you value what you're receiving here, please support our work by letting others know about it. They can register for this series at beyondawakeningseries.com. And please also consider supporting my work and enriching your life and your contribution to evolution by taking my course on an integral spiritual practice at theispcommunity.com. And to learn more about my other work and see videos, audios, and other writings, please visit integralspiritualpractice.com. I want to remind you of evolutionarymanifesto.com, John's website, and universespirit.com,
.org.
Lawrence's website. Now, excuse me, .org, universespirit.org. In 2 weeks from today, August 21st, I'll be holding a dialogue with Arjuna Arda entitled Cancel Your Subscription to Enlightenment. He asserts that we should jettison the very concept of, quote, enlightenment, unquote, which he says creates tremendous confusion and suffering and adds very little value to the spiritual path. But he says there's a lot that is of value, and we'll be getting into all that when we talk. On September 18th, I'll be speaking with A.H. Almas, Hamid Ali, the founder of the Diamond School, on responsive enlightenment. And enlightenment, he does like the word, but he uses it to describe an ability to respond in the moment. In October this year, I'll be having several quite interesting dialogues with neuropsychiatrist Daniel Siegel, biologist Bruce Lipton, and possibly activist Joanna Macy. So please stay tuned. There'll also be other remarkable conversations that we'll be scheduling in the time ahead. And now, let's all say goodbye. Let's open up the phone lines. So those of you on the computer can't be heard, but those on the phone lines can be. Let's all say goodbye. Goodbye, everybody. Thank you so much for joining us.
Bye. Wow, thank you.
Bye.
Thank you so much. Namaste.
Bye.